I am Rabbi Avi Killip. I work at Machon Hadar in Manhattan, who's running today. And I, within Machon Hadar, run Project Zug, which is Z-U-G, is our online Chavruta learning platform, which has 20 different courses that you can sign up for. And the cycle just started last Sunday, but there's still room to sign up. And you can sign up with a Chavruta and pick a class, or you can sign up and say what you're looking for in a Chavruta, and we actually match you in Chavruta. So I'm always and perpetually making a plug for Project Zug. So here's what we're going to do in the next hour. The theme for the day is nature, and I wanted to give us a chance to think a little bit about nature as metaphor for Torah, and when Torah is using nature to teach us something about our lives or about how humans and about Torah. So I wanted to start with just brainstorming in the room. What are analogies or metaphors that you can think of that relate to nature to Torah or Torah study? Tree of life is a big one. And water, right. So we have both of these, like, Eitz Chaim Hi, that Torah is a tree of life. And probably the second most famous one is water, which comes with this concept of just as you can't go 3 days without water, which I don't know how scientific that concept is, but it's definitely there in the Talmud, that you also can't go 3 days without Torah, and that's why we read Torah, you know, every 3 days in our calendar.
Did you say it's in the Talmud you can't go 3 days without water?
Yeah, I think it's a text from the Talmud. It could be that it's a Midrash, but I think it's Talmud.
It's a wilderness survival rule of thumb.
Is actually that number? That's so good to hear.
3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food.
3 weeks? Wow. I've never heard that. So that makes me feel very validated if we know it from that totally opposite sources. So we're going to study today a story that really plays on metaphors, and specifically nature metaphors, and it's the story of Rabbi Akiva, how Rabbi Akiva became Rabbi Akiva, you could say, because Rabbi Akiva does not have the yichus. He wasn't born into the line of rabbis. He comes to it later in life. And what we'll do is we're going to start... Normally, I would say, let's learn it in Chavruta, you'll learn it in pairs, and then we'll come together. I actually think we're going to start by learning through the beginning of the story together, and then when we get past the story and into a little bit of the straight-up metaphor part, then I'm going to let you turn into Chavruta to speak to each other, and then we'll come back together to conclude and see what we think of that. So how many people in this room have ever heard the story of Rabbi Akiva's first discovering Torah?
At the age of 40. I think it's like 10.
So many people know this idea that Rabbi Akiva only started studying at the age of 40. You know, I know that my mother always says that learning that was very meaningful to her in life, and she always felt that she could do anything, and then when she hit 40, suddenly it took on new meaning, and she felt like, you know, she felt differently about the story than she did previously to being 40. Okay. I gave you on this page the lead-in to the story, but we're going to actually start with the second paragraph here, which is, what was the beginning of Rabbi Akiva? So somebody read for us this paragraph. What was the beginning of Rabbi Akiva? Who could volunteer to read it in English, nice and loud?
They say that he was 40 years old and had not learned a thing. One time he was standing at the mouth of the well and said, "Who carved this rock?" They said to him, "The water that consistently falls on it every day." They said to him, "Akiva, did you not read waters wear away stone?"
Great. Thanks. There should be seats. Great. Okay. So let's look at our scene here. Akiva's 40 years old, and he hasn't learned a thing. And if you read in the Hebrew, he hasn't learned... It's actually... The Hebrew and the English don't line up exactly, but he hasn't learned even davar, even one word. And the word davar in Hebrew can be thing or word. So he hasn't learned a single thing. And he is standing at the mouth of a well, So presumably he's a shepherd or something. He's coming to draw water from the well, and he suddenly notices something about the rocks. What does he notice about the rocks? Yeah, that they're smooth, they're eroded, they're somehow, they don't look natural. So one thing that really strikes me about this is, you know, presumably he has seen this every day, right? He was 40 years old the first time he came upon a well. He's 40 years old, and for some reason this moment sparks him, right? For some reason this is the moment where he says, "Who carved this rock?" And he either thinks this, or he actually says it out loud. And why do we think he says it out loud? What gives us that instinct? Because they respond. We have no idea who they is here, right? Who do you think they is? Yeah, it's somebody else that's around at the time. It's maybe other shepherds. It's other people who happen to be standing right next to the well. And they answer him, you know, that's from the water. Water wears away stone. So they start with this, like, science lesson, right? It's a science question. Hey, how did the stones get so smooth? And they give him a science answer. Oh, water wears away stone. And then they do this really interesting thing, right? Which is that they say, Akiva, iata kore, like, haven't you read? Don't you know? And they quote the book of Job. And the Job quote says, water wears away stones. So when we get to the end of the story, we're going to follow that quote into the book of Job and see how that piece of Job interacts. But before we dive into that quote, like on the pshat level in the reading, why do you think they're bringing this quote here in this moment? Oh, yeah, sorry.
That he wasn't literate.
So it seems like they seem to think he should know, right? They're saying like,
they're implying that he's not
literate. Right? Don't you know, or shouldn't you have read? And also, it goes to show that right, their proof text is not like, didn't you study it in science class? They're saying, didn't you study this in the book of Job? Yeah.
There's also that. That given that he probably visited the well several times daily over many, many years, he would have noticed something. So there's a different noticing happening here.
Yeah. Right. So it's almost like if this was a like a child, you know, when children walk through the world and they have a question about everything, right? Why is this way? And why is that sign blue? And why is this, you know, why is this rock so smooth? That there's something different about this question. Maybe there's something, an existential noticing or opening or question that he has in this moment. Yeah. And I think that it's always striking to me that when we retell this story, you know, I feel like I had learned this story for years before I actually saw the story, you know, on the page in the Hebrew to see what the actual words were, that you think of it as a story of like, how do people find their way into Torah? And one answer is through nature, like through the, you know, you find your way to God through the mysteries of nature. You know, you go out to see a waterfall. That's how you find God. That's how you look for God. And that this story, it does start from that place of nature. But the one of the key things that happens here is that somebody quotes a verse. And that sometimes, like, the way someone finds a way in is, like, you hear, sometimes it's because you see the right stone at the right moment in the right way, but also sometimes it's because you hear the right pasuk in the right moment in the right way, that you know, it takes someone to offer you the verse in order to invite you into the project of Torah.
Yeah. The analogy for me here is Moshe and the burning bush.
Yeah.
And the notion is, there's nothing to say that he hadn't passed by that same bush as a shepherd day in, day out for days, and given that he was doing this for at least a decade, for at least years. And so there's the transformative element that's not only nature presenting it differently, but also your being ready personally to see the same thing that you may have seen many, many times.
Yeah, right. Right, I think that's really nice. And people say with the Moshe story that it's not just that Moshe might have passed the bush, it's that maybe every shepherd has been passing this bush, and Moshe is the first person to notice that it wasn't consumed. That in the same way, it's like, well, why are some people, why are most people not Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva is Rabbi Akiva? Because, you know, he notices this stone, and then when someone quotes this verse, he doesn't just say like, well, no, I haven't read that, actually. And then move on with his life.
This allusion, in yesterday's parsha, in Vayera, Abraham fell named Mamre. It was in the oak of Mamre that he saw God.
Right. And there's a lot of, you know, and people say the same about Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the ram. Like, well, did the ram just appear there, or was that ram there all along and it was a matter of noticing?
True. She just didn't see the water until it opened her eyes.
Yeah, right. It's a good parsha yesterday for noticing. Okay, so let's turn to page 2, and now we're going to see Rabbi Akiva's metaphor. And this... Also, I will say that I learned many times, and I learned it wrong. So we'll read what it actually says, and then I'll see how, you know, maybe that you may have come into this thinking you know the story, and you may have the opposite story also. Okay, so somebody read this immediately, Rabbi Akiva ruled. Just that short paragraph.
Immediately, Rabbi Akiva ruled.
A kal v'chomer.
Just as the soft water sculpts the hard rock stone. Words of Torah, which are as hard as iron, will all the more so carve my hard mind, which is but flesh and blood. Immediately he returned to learn Torah.
All right. So Rabbi Akiva does something called a kal v'chomer. A kal v'chomer is one of the ways that we deduce things in rabbinic Judaism, that we create laws from text. And the words kal v'chomer is like lesser, if the lesser, then the more so. So you would say, you know, if you're not allowed to eat one slice of pizza, then kal v'chomer, you can't eat the entire pizza, you know. Like if a smaller thing is true, then obviously a greater, more obvious thing would be true. So first of all, one thing that's interesting is like, And kal v'chomer is an idea that is supposed to be logic. Like, the way that it's used is that kal v'chomer is logic as opposed to other methods of deducing, which you actually sort of aren't allowed to do on your own. You have to have received a tradition from a teacher who used that trick, you know. So you may have heard of, like, there's a particularly sort of out there way of interpreting called the Gezeira Shava, which is, oh, well, the word... you know, pizza was used in this verse, and the word pizza was used in that verse, and therefore we know that what was true about this verse is true about that verse. That kind of deduction, you're not supposed to do on your own. You have to have inherited that kind of learning from your teacher. But a kal v'chomer is the logic you can do on your own. And so we see already here that, like, Rabbi Akiva has already got the head for this halacha stuff. He's already got the head for the Jewish law and the Jewish learning, because instantly... he's like not just making a logical assumption, but he's doing a, you know, he's a Don kal v'chomer. He's like judging, creating this kal v'chomer system. So here's what he says, right? He says, just as the soft can sculpt the hard, so presumably he's looking at the water is the soft, can sculpt the stone, which is the hard. If soft can sculpt hard, then obviously, then kal v'chomer, all the more so, can Torah, which is hard, sculpt my heart? And the word lev in rabbinic Hebrew can sometimes mean heart and sometimes mean mind, or rather, it means heart, but they thought of the heart and as the mind, and that you thought with your heart. You know, so all the more so Torah can shape my heart or can shape my mind. So this is not, I think, the most obvious option here, right? If water shapes stone, just like Torah can shape my heart, could be done in a lot more simple, clear way by using this metaphor that we're so comfortable with of water as Torah, you know, just like water / Torah, you know, can shape my stone / heart. And that's not what's done here, right? That would be like, my heart is stone until Torah came along and softened it. And actually, a lot of times when you see this text requoted, that's how it's simplified, or that's how it's given over. You know, it says like, oh, and Rabbi Akiva said, if water can shape stone, then surely Torah can shape my heart, because water is like Torah and my heart is like stone. But that's not what's happening here. Here, he says, water is soft, but Torah is hard. Torah is hard as iron. And in fact, iron is really a like a weapon. That's a weapon material here, and it's a... And it's, you know, maybe even alluding to a different part of the Torah that says there's a phrase, Torah is like iron, and it's a text about chavruta, that we sharpen each other's, you know, we sharpen each other's Torah basically by sparring in chavruta. And so here it's Torah shaping my flesh and blood heart. What's the significance of that? Do you see any difference in those two metaphors? Why insist on making... doing this sort of backflip to make sure that your Torah is not the stone, or water is not the heart, or water is not Torah. That your heart is not the stone.
It's kind of admitting the vulnerability a little bit in yourself, and that Torah is the greater of the two, or, you know, between yourself, in your heart, and your the Torah. Like, Torah is the stronger of the, you know, the two different.
Yeah. Right.
It's kind of admitting a vulnerability, or you know, with your heart being the softer of the two, Torah being you know, in this case, like the material of a weapon. It is saying that Torah is greater than, you know, kind of a more powerful material, I guess.
It's giving a lot of credit to Torah for someone who's never studied any Torah. You know, it's not the sort of skeptical, like, well, I guess that stuff could shape me if water can shape stone. Yeah.
It also seems to make people far more open to it. If your heart is hard like a stone, you are sort of impervious to a lot of stuff coming in.
Right.
Flesh and blood seem more open, more
susceptible. I think that's one of the things that I love most about this sort of backflip in order to do this, is that it allows you to say, I want to let Torah shape me, without saying, anyone who doesn't let Torah shape them, you have hearts of stone. You know, like, it's not a matter of, like, and for the first 40 years of his life, he had a heart of stone, and then he let Torah wear away at it and open it up and soften it. But it's, no, he actually had a heart of flesh and blood, and now he's inviting Torah in to change him. Yeah.
He may have had a heart of flesh and blood, but his application of Torah was as hard as his perception of Torah, which he was not exposed to before.
Meaning afterwards.
Meaning throughout his whole life. I mean, this is the man who single-handedly killed more Jews, is responsible for the killing of more Jews in that time period than any Roman general. He's the one who...
Meaning in terms of capital punishment?
In terms of Bar Kokhba, in terms of insisting that his people again and again revolt when it was clear that the Romans were not going to be beaten. That was the only the strongest authority at the time.
Yeah.
So you're getting...
So it doesn't feel surprising to you to see a weapon image.
It's frightening, because this is the man who ignores his own wife for 24 years out of preference to studying Torah, his heart. This is the man who is criticized by his fellow rabbis from the Pharisee cult, who are saying, you're too extreme, you're finding meaning and understanding of Judaism in tiny little fillets in the text.
I would say all of that is true, and Rabbi Akiva is one of the greats, and in order to read Midrashic and Talmudic stories, I think you have to always assume that there is a little bit of, there's always critique, and I definitely think in the story about Rabbi Akiva's wife, there's certainly critique, but there's also, you know, praising and endorsement, so it's good to balance both of those. Wait, there was one hand in the back I wanted to get. Is that? No? Okay, yeah.
I'm puzzled by the word returned.
Yeah.
He returned to learn Torah because My understanding is that he hadn't studied Torah until this point in time.
Right.
So how do you explain that?
So it's a good question. That's a phrase, that phrase of returned is used frequently. Is it's the same as when we say tshuva, when we say that someone did tshuva, you're lashuv, you're returning to something. Whether or not you ever were a better person, we still call it returning. Or a baal tshuva is a person who, you know, was not observant of mitzvot, who then takes them on, even though it's not frequently a situation of, well, they were observant and then they stopped and then they returned. But it's the...
That means he was aware.
Chozer b'tshuva.
It means he has been aware.
That he maybe knew about it.
He had been aware of these things even before he finally got around to
doing. Yeah, it's an... Or there's just a sense of returning to truth or something on like a more metaphysical level. Yeah.
For somebody who didn't study Torah, how does he know to invoke the Torah as being a tool that can move his heart?
Yeah, right. I think it's a great question, right? And that's, for me, what makes it feel so significant that this unnamed voice, quoted this Job pasuk to him, that they said that somehow introduced Torah into the story for Rabbi Akiva in a way that he, I think it's also, it makes me think, with the grander topic of nature, that it's like people who go into the forest and they find God, and there are people who go, and they say like, wow, Ashrei never moved me so much as it did, looking at the glacier or standing by the waterfall. And other people will say, well, I went into the forest and I didn't feel anything. Like some people don't find, they look at a stone and they don't find Torah, their way back to Torah. And that there's something, powerful here about that. Okay, so now we're going to see how exactly he finds his way into Torah. So someone read this next paragraph, he and his son. Yeah.
He and his son went and sat among the teachers of young children, nurslings. He said, Rabbi, teach me Torah. Rabbi Akiva held onto one side of the slate and his son onto the other. He wrote Aleph Beis and learned it. He wrote Aleph Tav and learned it. He wrote the instructions of the priest and learned it. He kept on learning until he learned the entire Torah, which makes me wonder, how long they were sitting there. He went and sat before Rabbi Eliezer and before Rabbi Yehoshua. He said, Rabbis, open up for me a taste, the reasoning of Mishnah. As soon as they told him a single law, he sat down with himself and said, this Aleph, why is it written? Why is it written? Why is this thing said? He returned and asked them and halted them with words.
All right. So here's the story in that one paragraph that we just read. That was Rabbi Akiva's entire journey, right, of learning, from learning the Aleph Bet all the way to being the one who stumps the greatest rabbis of the time. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua are Rabbi Akiva's teachers, and it's this voracious learning. He eats up the learning. So there's a couple things I want to say about this. The first is, I find this paragraph so poignantly reflective of our own Jewish educational setup, where it's almost like if you missed the chance to learn the Aleph Bet as a child, then we don't really do a great job of creating on-ramps for you to join the learning project. And one of the few on-ramps that you can find is when your kids go to preschool, and you can kind of follow their journey of learning the Aleph Bet. And that is in fact exactly what Rabbi Akiva does here. And I like to read this story in parallel with a story of Rabbi Eliezer, who at the age of 28 tells his father, I want to learn Torah. He's a little younger than Rabbi Akiva here, and his father says, you're too old to learn Torah. Wait, someday, get married, have kids, and your kids can learn Torah. And so it's Rabbi Akiva, somehow here, interesting, doesn't totally square away with the story of his then later wife is who is this kid and how does it all play together? But here he goes with his son, basically to nursery school. And here's, the image, apparently they would learn with chalkboards with slate, and people would sit across from each other and one would hold one side, one would have the other side. And apparently there are stories of, half the people learn to read upside down because it's if you were on the other side of the slate, then that was your position in the classroom. So that's this image of Rabbi Akiva on one side and his kid on the other. And that seems to be his way, He's way into learning, and he's ferocious, right? It's like Aleph, he like consumes it, you know, Aleph through Taf, he consumes it. This the instructions of the priests is Torat Kohanim is another word for Leviticus, which is a traditional, like in a traditional cheder, that's the first, believe it or not, we like to start usually now with Bereishit, I think. In like a traditional cheder, you start with Leviticus, that's where you start kids off with, so that's, you know, still him in the children's curriculum. You learn the alphabet, you learn Leviticus, you learn all of Torah, and then he says, you know, this word taste or reasoning, the word tam means both. He says, pidchuli tam mishnah, like give me a taste of mishnah, or like explain to me the reasoning of the mishnah. And then he sort of makes the dive into mishnah. And he does something really unique, right? Which is he questions every word. And in fact, he questions every letter, right? He says, like, why is this aleph here? Why is this bet here? And I think there's a, you know, it's like, this questioning of every letter is somehow, he keeps coming back to his teachers with more and more questions until he, amidan bedvarim, it's like he stumps them, he quiets them, you know, or he reaches the end of their answers. And I think there's also something here that's really powerfully in favor of inviting in people into the Beit Midrash, or having voices in the Beit Midrash who are outsiders, who did not grow up with it all. Because if you really grew up with it, then you maybe don't think to question every letter. Because when we read languages that we know, we don't even really see the letters. You know, some of us may see words, and some people, you know, you may say like, whoa, English, I basically take in a whole paragraph at a time. And that there may be something about Rabbi Akiva's like coming in as an outsider here that allows him to like, you know, he still remembers learning the alphabet. And so he's able to like break down these ideas and this reasoning down to the increment of an aleph and say like, well, why is that aleph there? Also, Rabbi Akiva is sort of famously known for believing that every word in the Torah is there for a reason. You know, when they're arguing over a pasuk, Akiva is the one who says like, well, every single word has a meaning. And so that also sort of fits with this story of like he's really into letters and he's really into words. And he stumps them. Yeah.
I just had a question about that. You can tell me if you know there with the light until then. I understand the big picture of what you're implying, that, you know, when you learn something as a child, you and you've known English, you know, your whole life, or you've known, you know, Hebrew yourself, you kind of see it in aggregate, but you don't see the specific details of it, and that, you know, learning it later has that benefit. But I don't understand the specific question. Why is it written? Like, what does that mean to say the aleph? Why is it written? Like, is he actually talking about, like, the letter, or is he talking about the letter in the context of a word that we don't know?
I think it's like, I would read it as he's saying like, well, why is this word in this verse? Or, you know, it's like on the grander scale, he would say like, well, why is this story in the Torah? Or like, why did the Mishnah teach this? But that his questions never end. You know, he's always saying, he sounds like a really annoying student, right? Like if you were a teacher, you'd be like, okay. You know, it's like if you were raising your hand right now and saying to me like, well, but why does it say the word chazer, you know, return? And then I said like, well, here's an answer. And then you said like, well, okay, but well, then why does it say the word Amidan? Well, then why does it say the word Dvarim? You know, like, why does the Dvarim has the mem on the end instead of a nun, which, you know. Yeah.
It seems to me there's actually growth in this learning here, perhaps. That questions could be asked, but there are different kinds of questions. The first question he asks is who? One having to do with the rock and the water.
Yeah.
Who question?
Is like who shaped this stone?
When or what? But the question he asks now is lama. He asks why. So that may have something to do with the teachers being prepared to ask the other kinds of questions, but not that kind of question.
Yeah, right. Yeah, true. And those are really hard questions to answer.
The why questions.
The why questions and the why questions at the aleph level. You know, it's like, I think a lot of rabbis would have a lot of sophisticated answers to complex questions. And then when you meet someone who's never been at a Shabbat table and they say, well, why is there wine on the table? You're like, oh yeah, why is there wine? Like, you know, that it's like something that feels like, oh, I could tell you why the challah is covered, and I could tell you why this blessing, and I could tell you why this verse we use, you know, but like when you get to the really, the more basic why sort of like why the whole premise questions. Okay, the next paragraph here is an analogy. He literally says, "Emshal lach mashal." I will analogize for you an analogy. I want you to just turn to the person next to you and read this paragraph together, and then try to just quickly say back and forth to each other what you think he's trying to get at, and then we'll come back. It's just going to be literally a two-minute chavruta. Let's come back together. Had anyone ever heard this part of the story before? It's always like fun, I think, especially when you're reading stories that you've heard the beginning of, to discover there's like whole second chapters that you didn't know were there. Okay, so here's the story. You know, a mason, a woodworker, a stone worker who is chiseling away at a mountain. He says, "I'm going to move this mountain from where it is right now into the Jordan River." Sort of a weird thing to want to do in general, but okay, he's moving the mountain into the Jordan. He's moving it one chink at a time, and people are coming and saying to him, "What do you think you're doing? You can't uproot and you're a crazy person, right? You can't move one pebble one at a time and think that you're going to uproot a mountain." And you know, it's like he hits the right boulder and the whole mountain topples over into the Jordan, and he has this like triumphant "Ein ze mekom cha ele makom ze," like, "Mountain, you don't belong here, you belong there, like, this is not your place, that's your place." So this is the analogy, and thus Rabbi Akiva did to Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Okay, so someone explain to us how this, like, what does this story have to do with Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer? No one has any thoughts. But okay,
is the
yeah.
River Torah?
Is the river Torah? Okay, say more.
One pebble at a time, which is Lora Regalachas, right? You can't learn Torah or have it affect you.
Yeah.
The Regalachas.
Yeah.
So the big boulder is when you finally get there, maybe. And
yeah. Nice. Okay. So what you're picking out is the incremental, the patience to do incremental work, which I think is a huge part of what this is about, right? It's like it's hard to miss also that we started with a story about water and stone, and now we have a story that involves water and stone, but they don't seem to necessarily match up, but it's like if they did match up, you might say he's trying to get as much stone into the water as possible. I think that's a really nice read. There was one other hand that was new. Yeah.
I think one aspect of this is a question of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
In other words, Akiva does something new and it's even better, or it trumps the teaching of the previous rabbis.
Yeah, so it's like he has a different technique. And in fact, his technique, as we were just saying, is like the one letter at a time technique. You know, so it's like you can imagine sitting and watching Rabbi Akiva say, like, you know, work through a text and say, like, why is there a hey? Why is there a lamed? Why is there a chav? Why is there a hey? Why is there a vav? It's like that would be maddening in the way that watching somebody try to move a mountain, you know, like one pebble at a time.
Isn't there also the story later on or somewhere else about Moses coming back into traveling time, coming back into the Beit Midrash,
right,
seeing Akiva teaching? Right. He has no idea what's going on.
Right. And in that story, the thing that Akiva's teaching about and making significance on is not only the letters, right, it's even more minute than the letters. It's the crowns on the top of the letters in the Torah. You know, it's like the font of the letters is what he's, you know, he's drashing literally. Like, this is, you know, he sees every little stone. Yeah.
Is there a suggestion within this last paragraph that he is basically, I've got a comment to the question.
Yeah, great.
Overtaking the learning or the instruction of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. And then my question would be, Is there any possibility that this is somewhat circular and that they, in the initiating paragraph we looked at, they said to him, might be those rabbis?
That they're the they? Oh, interesting. I have never thought about it that way. My instinct to say that these rabbis are not the original they is because he then seeks out rabbis and says, teach me. So it seems so I wouldn't think that they would be the people that are there instantly. But obviously the people there at the beginning know something.
But one can infer that in this concluding paragraph that he has...
he's like bested them somehow.
Well, taken over power or position in terms of...
Yeah, so I would say, we definitely have a received tradition that Yehoshua and Eliezer are Rabbi Akiva's teachers. Mm-hmm. There isn't the sense that, he's the next in their generations.
Okay.
But I do think that this phrase does help me understand, because, the previous paragraph that ended, he returned and asked them and halted them with words. It's like, well, why did they stop answering his questions? This story does make it sound like he somehow stumped them. Like, that's, yeah, he was able to do something that they weren't able to follow.
I think it's a surreptitious way of talking about undermining or chipping away at the Torah.
Yeah. That he's,
that it's not so bad.
Meaning that it's like questioning.
Questioning is good.
Yeah, right. And in fact that it's, it's maybe that questioning that will allow enormous boulders to move, or mountains,
if you don't understand it, it's an enormous boulder.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I guess there are two observations. One is, this is not questions without answer. He comes into the equation saying, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to send things into the Jordan. So whatever's involved in his intellectual curiosity or enterprise, he knows
the end point.
As opposed to just saying, would you consider this and see what we can develop?
Right.
His interpretation of the crowns and the individual letters radically changed rabbinicism and was recognized as such by his colleagues. So one is the intentionality of not understanding Torah, but going to a particular end that he brings to the equation.
Yeah.
The other element is, what's the science question here? What's the ecology question? It's not about the who, the what, the where, the when, and the why, it seems to me, that he's bringing to the table. He is saying, I'm about getting to the elements of what I think the world should be about, and I'm not looking for science. And that's frightening.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I would say there's two things that are huge that you just brought up. One is that he has a goal, an explicit goal that he says at the beginning, I'm trying to get this mountain into that river. And that is the goal that people say can't be done, and that's the goal that he's continues to work at and then does accomplish. And then the other piece I was going to say is I think there's something to the determination of, his unwilling to give up on that. And what he's unwilling to give up on, or what he's trying to do, or his core belief, is that things can change. Other people, when we usually talk about mountains, it's like, you can move the Muhammad to the mountain, but you can't move the mountain. It's like, one of the things we know about mountains is that you can't move them. That's what, when we use mountain imagery, that's what we mean. Mountains don't change. And Akiva is saying, this mountain's going to move, and I'm going to move it. And then he does move it, that there's something. There's a radical belief in that ability to change. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me get the back, and then you... Ruben,
I have a question. I'm puzzled, perhaps.
Yeah.
Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something.
Yeah.
So just because you have the power to move this mountain doesn't necessarily... I'm sort of walking you through what I've been thinking. So what's so great about knocking down... mountains are good. You can walk up them.
Great.
You can have a vista. You can have lunch up there.
Great.
You can see far.
Yeah.
You can... So the suggestion seems to me that nature, in terms of the nature thing, it's a good thing to control nature that the damming up of the river and the very
right. I was going to say it's seems that's what we need to read.
Good thing, but,
right?
But I don't. I know why we dam up rivers right now, but I don't think
we're
creating electrical power.
I want to follow this. Is that okay? And then we'll come back to your question, Basia.
Oh
yeah.
I was kind of talking about what he's talking about.
Okay.
Well, for example, like I raised a child. In the course of raising a child, you learn how to pick your battles.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Why move them out?
You pick up a lot of small stones. Okay, great. So luckily we have this pasuk, right? That's going to give us the answer. So in the next verse here, right, says Rabbi Tarfon said to him, to Rabbi Akiva here, Akiva, of you scripture says, he dams up the rivers and brings what was hidden to light. The things that were hidden from all people, Rabbi Akiva has brought them to light, right? So a nice thing in this quote here is that he moves from Akiva to Rabbi Akiva, you know, when he makes this change, right? So I also, like, I read this paragraph. I was like, this is totally unintuitive to me. Why do you dam up a river in order to bring things to light? You know, you think you would be like, opening up the river so it could, ideas could flow more freely. That this seems okay. So what I want us to do is to follow this pasuk into the, back into Job. And in fact, if you'll remember, the first verse that they said to him, "Water wears away stone," are both quotes from Job. I apologize. I don't know how I ended up putting the Job on this page with no verse numbers. That was unfortunate, but I'm sorry about that. Okay, but I want us to start with, I want us to start with the first quote and then read the second quote, and we have 5 minutes, so I'm going to take us through them, okay? So the first quote is actually 14:15, but I'm starting from 14:7 because I wanted us to see the context of the biblical story of Job that this text is being read against. And starts, "There is hope for a tree." I don't know why this isn't the catchphrase of every Jewish environmental organization, right? Ki yesh la'etz tikva. So beautiful. "If it's cut down, it will renew itself. Its shoots will not cease. If its roots are old in the earth and its stump dies in the ground, at the scent of water, it will bud and produce branches like a sapling." Okay, so what do we know about trees? They don't die, right? They can always come back. They always have tikva. They always have hope. Unlike people, right? "But mortals languish and die. Man expires, where is he? The waters of the sea fail, and the rivers dry up and are parched." So things that don't have hope are people and water. "So man lies down, never to rise. He will awake only when the heavens are no more. Only then be aroused from his sleep. Oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, conceal me in your anger." This sounds like Job, right? "If a man dies, can he live again?" And then let's skip to, "Mountains collapse and crumble. Rocks are dislodged from their place." This is an interesting verse because, right, I was just trying to make the point that, like, no, mountains are sturdy. Mountains don't change. The whole premise of this story is, like, if water can change rock, which doesn't change, which is hard to change. And here we have this verse in the story that's like, you know, "Mountains collapse and crumble, rocks are dislodged from their place, water wears away stone, torrents wash away earth, so you destroy man's hopes, you overpower him forever, you know, all hope is lost." So, you know, typical Job narrative, right? But it changes, I think, this quote of like, water wears away stone, in this context, is not like a, because water is so powerful. It's more of a, because stone, it turns out, is actually pretty unreliable, and is not that strong or not that permanent. And I would also just say the reason why I started so early, like, there's hope for a tree and not for man. It seems, I think, this story of Rabbi Akiva that we find in Avot Rabbi Natan is really a counter text. It's really trying to critique this concept from Job, right? Job says, man can't change. And Akiva is saying, my heart of flesh and blood can change, and Torah can change it. Like, this is, you know, you may think it's a pshita, or it's an obvious reading, you know, Rabbi Akiva, Torah can change you, that's nice. But, like, that's not obvious to Job, and Akiva's coming here to try to say, like, you know, something different. Okay, now let's do the last Job, right? This is The second text actually is quoting from 28:11. He dams up the rivers and brings what is hidden to light, right? Seems confusing. Here Job says, man sets his hand against the flinty rock and overturns mountain by the roots. Well, this is a story that sounds familiar, right? A man overturning a mountain. It's almost like the writers of that, you know, Emsholach Mashal, let me make up a fable for you. It happens to be a fable that I'm taking pretty much from this verse of Job, which you don't know if you don't follow the secret trap door from the Job verse. He carries out channels through rocks. His eyes behold every precious thing. He dams up the sources of the stream so that hidden things may be brought to light. It's like, you know, it may be just as confusing here. For some reason, when I read it in this context, I see it as like, you know, you're trying to get something that you think is at the bottom of this river. And if I can dam up the river right above the place that you're trying to get to, then maybe, you know, what was hidden will come to light. That, like, suddenly I'll be able to see the bottom of the riverbed and I'll be able to get something deeper that was there underneath that I couldn't otherwise get. But where can wisdom be found? Where is the source of understanding? No man can set value on it. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, I do not have it. So again, Job, you know, here's this metaphor, right, that we have of Rabbi Akiva, who's damming up the stream to try to find answers. And here is Job coming back to say, if we like flip the order, to say like, no, wisdom, you don't find wisdom in nature. That's not where wisdom is. Wisdom is only in, like, you know, coming from God or in some distant, you know, some distant time that is not Eretz HaChaim. It's not the land of the living. It's not the people. So I bring this text, you know, I was thinking and prepping it like, oh, I don't have like a really clear conclusion that I want you to walk away with. I hope that it gives you a lot of interesting food for thought in terms of the relationship between nature and humanity and change and Torah study, and also in really seeing the way in which Torah and Midrash were very aware of the natural world around them in terms of using those metaphors and images to try to build and design the sort of different approaches and shapes and perspectives that they wanted to bring to life. Let me see. I was told to end at 1:05, and it's exactly 1:05. So, thank you all. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.